Clean Water Act, who's in charge? Duffy, we're looking for the for another one that's elsewhere, but we're glad you're here. I'm Tim Wheeler. I'm a reporter with the Baltimore Sun, the issue here is one concerning essentially who's responsible for carrying out the Clean Water Act and you know how that plays out. It's an issue that's fraught with some big stakes for all parties concerned. The Environmental Protection Agency has been coming under some legal and political fire lately for some of the actions it's taken to enforce the Clean Water Act. Here in Florida, they're being sued by a whole range of parties, a couple of which are here. They're also being sued for actions in the Chesapeake Bay, where I'm from, by one of the parties who's here. And they're getting called to Capitol Hill more and more often to sort of explain what it is they're doing here. So we're going to explore the issues, we hope, and have a good discussion. We've got a good panel here. I think representative one of some of the issues. I'm going to introduce them briefly. There's more detailed information in the program online about their bio and contact information. To my far left is Drew Bartlett. He's the director of the Division of Environmental Assessment and Restoration for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Drew is responsible for carrying out the Clean Water Act for the state of Florida. It's a big responsibility. And before that, he's been with the department, looks like what, 15 years?
Well, that was with EPA. I was with EPA before.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So you've been on both sides here. All right, and he's has an industrial engineering degree from Georgia Institute of Technology and a master's in business administration from Georgia State. To his right is Don Parrish. He's a senior director for regulatory relations for the American Farm Bureau Federation public policy team in Washington. And under that, his primary responsibility is to deal with Clean Water Act issues as they concern farmers. Don, before joining the Farm Bureau, was an economist at Auburn University, and is from Washington. To my right is Bob Sussman, senior policy counsel to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson. Helps her out and advises her on a whole range of policy issues in the agency. He's been deputy administrator of EPA under the Clinton administration, and also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and as before all that, he had about 30 years of private environmental law practice in Washington. And academically, he's a Yale man. So, and last but not least, to my far right is David Guest, managing attorney for Earth Justice office in Tallahassee. David's been involved in environmental litigation since 1984. Before that, worked in for legal services and poverty law. David, I left your academic qualifications off here, so.
I graduated from kindergarten in 1955.
All right.
And have gone from there.
Started out as a child, did you?
Went to University of Chicago Law
School. All right. So why don't we start with Bob and Bob, what is it that the EPA is doing in this situation? What is the what's the issue? What is EPA? Why is EPA getting sued?
Well,
take a microphone if you could there. Yeah.
Why are we getting sued? I guess I'll leave that to the people who are suing us, but try to give you a perspective on how we see the world of water quality, and particularly how we see the federal-state relationship, which I think is more or less where the front lines of environmental protection are right now in Florida, in the Chesapeake Bay, in Appalachia, where we have mountaintop mining issues, and elsewhere in the country, and the concern that we hear from some of the stakeholders and some of the states is that we're being too dictatorial. We're choking off initiative and innovation and local decision making in some of these watersheds that are under threat. We don't see it that way. The model on which the Clean Water Act is based and on which many of our environmental statutes is based is a cooperative federalism model, and that envisions a division of responsibility between the federal government and the states. It envisions a partnership. We believe that the partnership relationship is a very important relationship. We don't espouse a one-size-fits-all approach, but we do have a very important national policy role and a very important oversight role that has been assigned to us by Congress. The goal of the Clean Water Act is assuring that our waters in this country are fishable and swimmable. That's an aspirational goal, but by the same token, a goal very strongly stated by Congress. And achieving that goal requires water quality standards that are protective and that are science-based. And while the states have a role in setting those standards, EPA has a very important role as well. We have an obligation to review and to approve the water quality standards adopted by the states, and where the states have not adopted water quality standards or they're under protective, we have an obligation under the Act to decide whether stronger standards are necessary, and if the states don't develop those standards, we have an obligation to develop them ourselves. So we do have a very strong role in assuring a minimum floor of water quality protection around the country. We have a role of assuring consistency among state programs, even allowing for innovation and local decision making. And I think we also have an important leadership responsibility, which is where the science that our professionals are reviewing is bringing to light a serious water quality issue. I think we have an obligation to put it on the screen of the public, to put it on the screen of stakeholders and state decision makers. I think nutrients is a very good example of that. All the
does everybody know what the issue is with nutrient pollution? Yes? Okay.
No, that's good.
Excellent.
It's a problem that we consider very serious. We think it has public health implications. It has economic implications, certainly has profound implications for the health and sustainability of our water bodies around the country. I think there's strong scientific evidence documenting the severity of nutrient problems in multiple watersheds, certainly strong evidence documenting those problems here in Florida. And our objective is to see the states do more to address nutrients than they have done, and we have done that in a number of different ways. I think one example is the Chesapeake Bay, which is really a nutrients problem when you come right down to it. And we have I think a very comprehensive framework that I can discuss in more detail for addressing nutrients in the Bay. Here in Florida, there has been, I think, a longstanding federal and state focus on the nutrient issues. The state-federal relationship has not always been harmonious, but I think it's basically a relationship of partnership and trying to do the right thing as we see it. And then we have many other states around the country where we are encouraging action on nutrients, and I think it's fair to say that a number of the states are being responsive. We do believe that numeric nutrient criteria are a very important, maybe an essential tool for addressing nutrients. We're encouraging states to jump in and develop standards. We are seeing a number of states step up around the country, and so we are we're encouraged by some of the progress that we're seeing. I just want to make sure everybody understands that if progress is not sufficient, we do have responsibilities under the Clean Water Act, and we're prepared to step up. But our hope, as I said at the outset, is to address this issue within the framework of cooperative federalism.
Okay.
So, Tim, I'll stop there if that's okay.
We'll come back to you in a minute. Drew, do you disagree with the EPA over whether you have a nutrient problem or not? Or?
No, we don't disagree. The state of Florida does have a serious challenge when it comes to nutrient pollution. We do have a number of impaired water bodies, and we do have some pretty aggressive programs to deal with those impaired water bodies. And so, you know, they're really, when you look across the nation and you look at what we do in Florida, there's no other state that has removed more discharges to their water bodies than Florida. There's no other state that has reduced the volume of discharge, reused the water in Florida to eliminate that discharge. And there's no other state in the nation that has aggressively implemented best management practices on agricultural operations than Florida. And we take nutrients very seriously in Florida.
So what's the problem then?
Well, I'm not here to say there is a problem. There is a problem with nutrient pollution.
Right, right. But I mean, what's the problem with your relationship with EPA here right now?
There, you know, what we are committed to in the state of Florida is numeric nutrient criteria. And we started deriving numeric nutrient criteria since 2002. We assembled a technical advisory committee. We started collecting data across the state to see if we could derive these numbers that we could apply to rivers, streams, lakes, and estuaries. And it was really in the 2009 timeframe that we were coming together with these numbers. We had the science. I mean, it takes millions of dollars to collect the data necessary to derive the science to develop these numbers. And we were just poised to get those numbers together when all the litigation occurred and EPA stepped in to adopt the standards. They used our science. The numbers essentially are the same as the ones that we had derived, and they did promulgate standards in the state of Florida. There is conflict as a result. The department has not sued EPA. The department instead has decided to take up and try to adopt rulemaking and adopt these standards in the state rules in order to allow EPA to withdraw their rules, and then they get implemented.
So the issue is you want to be the ones who are actually...
That's correct.
...choosing the standard, but it doesn't sound like there's much difference in from a technical or real-time...
Throughout the entire issue of nutrient of managing nutrients, it is not the debate. There's a debate on science, but it's really as the conflict and the challenges and the debate really gets escalated is how you implement them. You know, how are people affected? How are ratepayers affected? How are agricultural operations affected? You know, how are people's livelihoods affected? That's always been the fundamental question when dealing with controlling nutrients. Here we have a set of standards that we need to implement. The numbers are not different. It's how you apply the numbers and how people comply and are affected by the numbers that is the debate. You've heard cost estimates regarding the numbers, and they have an entirely huge range. And it on how much it could cost households and ratepayers and agricultural operations. And that is always the question always is, you take the number that's in the box in the books, and how does it apply to that person? And many people can come at it from many different perspectives on how do you apply that, and that's what causes the range of costs.
What are the range of costs?
Well, let's take ratepayers, for example.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about households.
Households, yes, right. for utility rates. It could be as little as $2 a month or as much as $40, $50 a month in increased costs, depending on how the numbers are applied.
And that's money to pay for what?
Upgrades and sewage treatment.
Okay, across the state.
Right. And so we are trying to figure out and trying to craft rules that not only include the numbers but include all the measures necessary to comply with the numbers and to keep the water bodies healthy and do it in a manner that avoids unnecessary costs, if you will, so that where you do need to upgrade treatment, you upgrade it to the point where it will provide that protection and not beyond. And so as we are trying to craft our rules and get them in books, not only are we looking at just the numbers, but we're also looking at adopting the path to comply, and so that everyone knows what is expected of them. And that's a little bit of a difference in how our mandate at the state level versus EPA's mandate at the federal level. They are mandated to just adopt the numbers. But as we go forward, we are also having to adopt those rules that speak about how to comply. And so, we are working on that. We have numbers. We're essentially using the same numbers EPA promulgated in the state of Florida. We're also looking at getting the estuary numbers derived. We have draft numbers for all of our estuaries, and we've proposed the southern tip recently, and it's an expedited proposal, which is unfortunate, but we are really trying to get these nutrient numbers in place as soon as possible.
Okay. Don, what's the issue from the farmer's point of view here? Why are you all upset with EPA here?
With regard to numeric nutrients?
Well, yeah, let's start with Florida. Let's talk about that one.
Okay. I would say more than anything else, I think it is really not recognizing the things that agriculture has already done to contribute to this effort. And also recognizing, as Drew says, once you start implementing conservation, you're still doing it out in the open. That, there's no way to kind of put a roof over growing crops. The way we see cooperative federalism work is that EPA helps with the standard setting process, but they also have to work with the states, and it's not a final process until the state approves it. These are going to be, the kinds of standards that EPA are putting into place are going to really force very difficult economic decisions. And we see agriculture coming under huge pressure because of that.
What would be the issue with meeting the standards? It sounds like Drew says they're going to adopt essentially the same ones that EPA was already proposed.
How do you, from my standpoint, how do you adopt a standard that is near pristine and then expect to produce food and fiber for people or homes or roads or places where people work? It's very difficult to have near pristine standards and still be able to produce food for, you know, the population of this country and, you know, by the end of this month, 7 billion people in this world. You can only do so much. I mean, droughts, a 2-inch rain results in a different nutrient load than a 4-inch rain. And it's just going to be very difficult in the fact that it's not only going to drive cost of production up, it's going to potentially drive land out of production. And that's going to have a huge impact on the livelihood of farmers and ranchers.
How big is the agricultural sector here in Florida, do you know?
You know, I did not look up the specifics of the ag sector here in Florida, but it's a diverse sector. It's very large.
Bigger than a bread box. I mean, we've got everything from this, obviously the famous Florida citrus to sugar and cattle.
And
vegetables.
You know, fruits and vegetables all across the state. I mean, it's things that people eat and buy from the grocery store every day. I mean, it is part of the fruits and vegetables stand that everyone goes into when they go into a Whole Foods or their supermarket.
Well, let me understand something. Is the Farm Bureau saying, in essence, that farmers are already doing all they need to do, all they can do?
Tim, agriculture, and I'll say it like this. We've looked at agriculture's environmental footprint, and since 1960, we're producing on 30 million acres less land today than we did in 1960. We're using less water, less fuel, less resources all the way around. And no matter how you cut it, our environmental footprint is smaller. In terms of nutrients, we are producing 87% in the aggregate more product today than we were in 1980 with 5% less nutrients. I don't believe there's any other sector in the economy that has come close to that efficiency. No matter how you cut it, since 1960, we've doubled population in this country, and we have reduced the amount of land that we're producing product on. And we have the same numbers of animals in this country across the board that we did in 1960. I don't know how, from a physical standpoint, Tim, we're able to feed this country with populations doubling, with less resource in productivity than we had in 1960.
Okay. Now, one last question here. You, the Farm Bureau, joined in the original legal challenge to the EPA standards with, at that time, I guess, Florida Department of Environmental Protection was the was also a you did not join? I thought I saw okay. But you all have asked them to withdraw the standards.
Right.
He's telling us now that they're basically the same standards. You gonna oppose them?
We think there's a different approach. We think when states lead an approach, states are able to kind of balance their environmental protections, their ability to grow economically, and their social issues that kind of are wrapped up in that. EPA does not, you know, it is not EPA's job to balance that out for the state of Florida. They can't do it. They're ham-handed. They do it with a meat cleaver. The people in the state of Florida can do it, and they can do it in a way that balances out these economic, these social, these environmental considerations, and do so in a way that doesn't just hammer the economy or take away the ability and the flexibility of the state of Florida to achieve the goals that it needs to achieve. That's what cooperative federalism is about. It's not about EPA coming in with a heavy-handed approach and a one-size-fits-all approach. That's what they've done here, and it's not right. That's not the way we've achieved the kinds of gains that we've achieved since the enactment of the Clean Water Act.
All right. Thank you. David, you're the troublemaker who helped get this whole thing started.
Well, thank you.
How did you start? How do you see this? Is it You know, is it an issue of how you implement the standards, or is there still an issue over the standards themselves?
Well, it's two things. And let me put it first in context and give you a little background. What happens in Florida is that we have this nightmarish toxic algae problem. It's growing worse all the time. Wakulla Springs used to be one of the most magnificent places in the world, biggest spring in the world, perfectly clear. Now it's toxic slime. The Coosatchie River was the same this year. There were signs all over it that says if you get in the water, you'll get sick. Don't let your kids in it. If your dog drinks out of it, it'll kill it. The same thing happened in the St. Lucie a few years ago. A 100-mile-long toxic algae outbreak was present last year in the St. Johns River, and it came back again this year. We have had an adversarial relationship with the EPA for the last couple decades, and it produced, in this case, a lawsuit against the Bush administration, which then worked out an agreement with DEP, the state DEP, that they were going to cooperate on a rule. DEP came up with a really good rule, but what happened is they ran into a buzzsaw of opposition by the sewage industry, and they really sort of killed it. And the sewage industry then threw the hot potato to EPA, and they got stuck with having to do it. And they adopted the same standard that the state had proposed, essentially. Now, the biggest opponent to this, apart from sewage, has been agriculture. The way the thing really works in reality is that the Clean Water Act does not apply to agriculture. It imposes no requirements on them. That's strictly a state program. And here's how the state program works. It's BMPs, that is farming practices. They fill out a form that has check boxes on the front. And if they check the boxes and say that's what they intend to do, they get a presumption of compliance with water quality standards and Clean Water Act and an exemption from monitoring. So it's the ultimate free pass. These BMPs are not only cost-effective, about 90% of the time they save the farmer money or make the money. The remaining 10%, they're cost-neutral. They are very rarely complied with when you actually look. Well, rarely is an exaggeration. The time when they get measured, what you find is that, for example, in the St. Johns River implementation project, the report was only 30% were even filling out the boxes. So it isn't really there. But we have seen extraordinary hyperbole from the agricultural industry, and give you a perfect illustration of that. The previous Commissioner of Agriculture said that these standards were the worst thing that had happened to the agricultural industry in Florida in 150 years. Well, let's hope that he wasn't referring to emancipation. And the estimates that he once provided were about $1 trillion in compliance costs. The actual gross agricultural product of Florida is $7 billion a year, which would mean that his compliance costs were 140 years of total agricultural production. That gives you a sense on the level of hyperbole that we're dealing with. And we've got the same from the sewage industry. They put bill stuffers in saying it was going to be $700 a year. The way they got those numbers was by assuming that every single sewage treatment plant in the state would require reverse osmosis for every drop of sewage they produce, their effluent, including the huge fraction that does deep well injection. So what they were going to do was do reverse osmosis and then dispose of it into the ground. And it was just absolutely crazy. When you look at the actual experience of sewage treatment plants that upgrade, what you find is two things. Throughout the state, a substantial number of plants can meet the standard right now. Some of them do meet the standard right now, and it didn't break the bank for them to get there. They had to phase it in. So it is affordable, and that's established by our own experience. What we have instead here is contrary to what folks are saying here, the DEP proposal is a repeal of the numeric nutrient standards. And the reason it's a repeal is to give it a very quick overview. Yes, the numbers are there. Yes, they use the numeric limits that are there. But then they say that those limits don't apply unless you establish that your pollution level actually triggers a slime outbreak or something like that. And only if you can prove that connection is it there. And so the effect of it is this, is that, yes, we have a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit sign for the curve, but the way DEP's rule works is that you can't get a speeding ticket for going around the curve at, in excess of that unless you prove affirmatively that going 46 miles an hour will cause an accident. And so there is no rule. There is no effective rule. This is a repeal. And we're hopeful that that EPA will stand firm and say that's not really a rule. And I think that there's support for that, because if you look around the state, here you get two things that you find. One is that every editorial board in the state has been condemning what DEP did and has been applauding what the EPA has done. And that's uniform throughout the entire state. And two, despite all the bill stuffers, besides the propaganda, besides the attack videos and everything else, the storyline that Floridians don't want clean water, that they don't want an end to the toxic slime, is simply not been supported by the evidence.
Thank you, Dave. So if your numbers are basically in agreement, why don't you get out of the way and let Florida do do what it says it's going to do?
Well,
could pull the mic up a little closer. There you go.
First of all, let me say that we're encouraged that Florida is getting back in the game on this. Our goal all along has been to see Florida step up with strong and protective numeric nutrient criteria. There's been a fraught history here, the flavor of which I think you've gotten both from David and Drew. There's been an unfortunate yin and yang over the years where the state has come very close to the starting line and done a lot of very good technical work, but in the end has not moved forward, and we have had to step in. We are encouraged that they're taking another run at it. We think that that's the right thing for them to do, and we have said all along that if the state adopts and the legislature approves numeric nutrient standards, which we feel are protective, are science-based, will meet the goals of the Clean Air Act, we're very happy to get out of the way. We don't at this point know what the outcome of the state process is going to be. There is an active technical dialogue between our experts and the state's experts, and we're looking very closely to see whether we think the state has met the mark. And as I said before, if the state does meet the mark, and we're comfortable with it, and we think it's protective, and we think we can approve it, we're very happy to get out of the way.
It's been said, though, that it's the state's job to set these standards. Why is EPA, exercising essentially a veto authority?
Well, I would describe it as a veto authority. I would say that we're performing our responsibility under the Clean Water Act, as I said before. It's our job to approve state standards, and so we have to exercise a judgment there whether those standards are protective or not.
Can you, on a stream-by-stream basis here in Florida, does the EPA have the resources to set a standard that is protective of the stream and not so overly ambitious that it has economic and social implications for the watershed? And, you know, that, because that's important. I think that's what Drew is trying to achieve. He's trying to say, you know, we want a healthy water body. But you're setting standards that really don't relate to the health of the water body. Is that correct?
Well, I would violently disagree with that, Don. I think, first of all, the standards that we set in Florida, the standards that we're setting in the Chesapeake Bay are based on very extensive science. And
I have a
Don't interrupt. I'll come to you right after. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
And there are standards that we think are necessary to protect water quality. And I'm not going to apologize for our science. It's peer reviewed. We have world quality experts doing the science. We will stand behind it in any court and before any scientific review body. The second thing I would say is that these water quality problems here and in the Chesapeake Bay are very serious problems. They are getting worse in the state of Florida, as David said. They are not getting better. In the case of the Chesapeake Bay, which is beloved by the citizens of all of the jurisdictions that border the bay, we have a history of 25 years of failure, the result of which has been a contaminated water body with a fishery that is the shadow of its former self. So if we want to solve these problems, we gotta step up, we gotta use science, and we gotta ask hard questions about what's going to protect water quality. The other thing that I would say...
Let's stop right there for a second, okay, so we can get other folks in on this. Don, you had some issues over the science,
just,
I gather?
Just briefly.
All right. Okay.
I've got a letter here from one state that says... Your science creates outrageous anomalies and is inconsistent with current scientific knowledge.
What state is that?
Virginia.
Virginia.
I've got letters.
This is on the Chesapeake Bay.
I've got letters from your region that acknowledge that there's limitations to your science and there's problems with them. And I've got the state of New York saying your science is fraught with deficiencies. So it's important that we work from a really understandable and commonsensical scientific baseline, but it's something else to kind of push through something quickly, like you did here in Florida. You just come in and did it, regardless of what was important for that water body. And you've done the same thing with your comment process in the Chesapeake Bay. You've done the same thing with your model in the Chesapeake Bay. It, you know, it's fraught with problems. It does not work. You can't make specific decisions based on it. But yet you're doing that, and that's going to have huge implications.
Yeah.
It's going to have huge implications for farmers, and it's going to have huge implications for the economy across the board.
Question, though, Don, you quote the criticisms of the states. They have not sued EPA over this, have they?
No.
Yeah. And to this point, they're complying?
To this point, they are working with EPA. Yes, they are.
Okay. All right.
Well, if I could just jump in here, the states are working with us because they share our objective of protecting and restoring the bay. And they're also
and
working...
agriculture doesn't. Agriculture doesn't. Agriculture hadn't made progress in the bay.
I said the states, the state governments, okay. Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Delaware... and New York. I'm not saying that there aren't disputes along the way. That's to be expected as part of this process. But there is a shared commitment by all of these jurisdictions to restoring the bay, and I think a shared recognition that we have a history of 25 years of failure. And if we want to change course, we need to take strong action. I won't say that the science is absolutely perfect, but I will say with confidence and categorically that the science is good enough to support the decision-making that has to be made on the Bay good enough to tell us what reductions we need to achieve water quality standards and good enough to help us allocate those reduction responsibilities among the states in the watershed. And I think it's really disturbing to take a dispute about a model, which is a fairly narrow and limited dispute, and to use it to suggest...
Hold on. You bring up the issue of the model. I don't know. Does anybody understand what we're talking about here?
No.
All right. Do you briefly explain that? Go ahead.
You want me to explain it or him? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I will explain it fairly briefly because I'm not a technical guy and I can't go into all the details, but we have a model that's been developed over a long period of time. It's not an EPA model. It's a model which reflects input from universities.
This is essentially a computerized simulation of how the Bay watershed operates with programming in the estimates of the inputs of
right. That's exactly right.
Nutrients, sewage,
and the goal
runoff.
is to feed into the model information about the loadings associated with various sectors who are contributing to pollution in the Bay, and to simulate what the impact would be of reducing those loadings. And I think it's been, on the whole, a very, very good planning tool. I think it is well accepted scientifically. As with any model of this complexity that relies so heavily on input data, there will be questions about the quality of the input data and whether the input data can be refined and improved. And we certainly recognize that improving the model inputs is desirable and worthy. We're working on that. I think the states are being very, very helpful there, but we categorically reject the notion that the limitations of this model preclude its use as a planning tool for the Bay.
But aren't you using it as a regulatory tool, Bob? Mm-hmm. But aren't you using it as a regulatory tool?
What do you mean a regulatory tool?
That's different. You're allocating loads with this model that have regulatory implications, and that's different than a planning model.
Well, I think it's the same thing. When I say it's a planning tool, ultimately our objective in the Bay is to reduce loadings, and by reducing loadings to that means reducing the contribution of different sectors. It means reducing loadings in individual streams and rivers that feed into the Bay, and so you have to make decisions about how much pollution reduction you need, which sectors have to do it, and where the reductions have to take place. And so, yes, it is a planning tool which tells us where do we need to look to get the reductions that we need to achieve water quality improvements in the Bay. If we didn't use this model, I think, frankly, we would be dead in the water. We would not be making any progress at all. And so our approach is to use a model that we think is a pretty good model to make decisions on allocations and responsibilities so that we can move down the road, getting loading reductions as we go, and refine and fine-tune the model as we develop a better understanding of the inputs that that the model uses. And I want to say again, I think our jurisdictions are basically very supportive of that effort, even as they as they should, raise questions about how we can improve the model.
Thanks, Bob. I want to steer this back to Florida for just a second here.
That's fine.
Yeah. No. David sort of drew a distinction between your approach to the application of the numeric nutrient standards, of how you all were going to actually enforce these standards. And the standards themselves, actually, so people understand, essentially these are goals. Basically, this is where you want to get the level of pollution in the water to that level in order to have a healthy water body. So David was saying you all may be pretty much in agreement on the actual number, but it's how you apply it, and that's where they see all the difference. Tell me about your view on how that's being applied.
Okay, and you wanted me to stay out of the weeds in this discussion too,
okay.
Right, Tim?
I'll
do my best. It's you know, and David likes to use the speed limit analogy, and it, you know, it is an effective analogy, but the analogy is that the state or government or federal or state government would come down and say all the roads in Miami need to have a 45 mile per hour speed limit. And as we know, as we drive around Miami, that's not necessarily protective in the school zones and maybe overly safe in the interstates. And so what we want to do is take that goal, that 45 miles per hour, and also couple it with what is happening in the water body itself, what is happening in the road itself. If the water body is impacted, even though it's meeting that speed limit or that threshold, then we need to reduce it even below that threshold. If you're above that threshold and going faster than 45 on I-95, but conditions are safe or the water body is healthy, well, let's you know, keep it that way. You know, let's keep that water body healthy. The one thing we coupled to our standards, you know, we have the number, we have the biological check, you know, to make sure that the water body is healthy. But what we also coupled with it is no downward trend in nutrients, no adverse trend in nutrient pollution. So if the nutrients are even below the threshold, below these standards, but you observe a downward trend, we flag it, we have to address it. If it's above the thresholds, but it's still biologically healthy, and you see a downward trend, we flag it, you have to address it. And so it does couple that implementation. EPA's standards really also embrace that approach. They just included a lot more process in embracing it. So if you didn't meet the standard, you could document its health, like we would suggest you need to do. But then you'd have to petition EPA. EPA would have to set the new standard, go through a public process. And so there was a lot of process involved. So ours was just trying to hardwire that expectation into the rules itself without the additional process. As I approach my bosses, asking them to for more resources, for more process, is something they usually embrace. And so we're really trying to make sure that we get all those implementation provisions within this rule.
David.
Let me just respond very briefly to just a handful of things. One is that these are not standards for pristine at all. Give you the practical illustration most recently. The tributaries to Lake Okeechobee, the big lake, historically were about 40 parts per billion phosphorus. The state and the feds together worked out a load limit that translated to 113 parts per billion before these standards were adopted. And when the standards were adopted, that one, the controversial ones, they came out at 120, three times what the natural level was and higher even than what the state had worked out. These are very, very lax standards. There are 24 states in the United States that have adopted limits like this, and 21 of those 24 are more stringent than the ones in Florida. And no, there are not, this is not, I think the road analogy that Drew makes is an excellent one. And the suggestion would be that all the roads in Miami-Dade would be one speed limit. In fact, the way you do roads is say you get them into classifications. You know, arterial roads, residential, schools, highways, and so forth, and that's what's done here. There are six classes of rivers. There are three classes of lakes, and they're springs. And each one of them are different, and that corresponds to the speed limits. What we see the state doing that is simply an impediment to implementation of the limits is that you can't apply the speed limit until you do a study of that quarter-mile section of road that determines that it ought to be 45 instead of 47 miles an hour. The purpose of a speed limit sign on a curve is to have a real practical speed limit, and it doesn't mean that if you go 46, you're going to roll your car, or that 44, you won't. And that's the concept. And what's happening here is that as a mechanism to impede the effectiveness of the speed limits, you have to have a confirmation that particular speed on that mile-long section of road really is the dangerous speed that's out there, and that thwarts the effectiveness of speed limits themselves.
Okay. Well, as you can see, there's quite some difference of opinion here. Some of it's very technical. Some of it's legal. I think at this point we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. The SCJ members and working journalists have preference for asking questions. I would ask you when I call on you that you identify yourself, state your question as succinctly as possible, and we'll go from there. Start over here.
Susan Moran, freelance journalist in Boulder, Colorado. So I'm trying to tease out the science.
Yeah, okay. The question is to Don Parrish of the Farm Bureau. What would it take in terms of science to satisfy you that you needed, that the farmers needed to do more? Is that essentially it?
I think we have a lot of agreement with Mr. Bartlett here. It has a lot to do with the health of the water body. And if you're protecting beneficial uses, designated uses, and you know, then numbers become arbitrary. And it's important that you protect the health of the stream, but yet allow for all of the things that a state needs to allow for, which is growth, which is jobs, you know, food production. That's the important part. And from my standpoint, you know, that's where the science has to really be as precise and as effective as possible. You can't just do things that are arbitrary and expect there to be no impacts on people.
That's right. I mean, I guess the question you're saying, in essence, that you have to allow for whatever's happening on the land in terms of gauging whether you need to improve the health of the stream.
Well, I'm saying the health of the stream dictates what ultimately you have to do in
on
terms of you know, are you on a glide path to improving water quality? Are you, you know, is the water quality sufficient to protect the standards, the designated uses that are on that water? And if it is, then you can have growth, you can have activity. Because unfortunately, if you set arbitrary standards that are too high, that's going to constrain the economy. It's going to constrain things. It's going to constrain agriculture. And if you set it arbitrarily, it has a ripple effect throughout the economy.
Jerry, you wanted to say?
Yeah, and just to get at the science question, and we heard this as we were going through our rulemaking. EPA has heard it as they went through their rulemaking. What you can get across and convince everyone needs to happen is when you can derive those numbers based on a cause and effect relationship. And so do you know how much additional phosphorus or how much additional nitrogen would actually impact the use and impact the biology? And we could find that for lakes, we could find that for springs, but we tried desperately, but couldn't necessarily find it for every flowing river in the state. And so there's a second approach you use, which is you find all your healthy and least impacted water bodies and try to mimic those nutrient concentrations in every water body.
Is that the so-called negative approach?
No, it's called a reference-based approach. And what you know when you mimic those concentrations in other water bodies is if you do, you'll protect those water bodies. What you don't know is if it is one or two micrograms above that number, whether it's actually impacting the water body. And then every water body is really going to behave differently when it comes to streams. And so even if you derive and mimic, it doesn't necessarily mean you will always protect. And so it's important to really not only adopt standards that look at those nutrient concentrations, but also include standards that look at the biology of the stream so that you know that if you have you'll have the complete picture when you collect all the data.
Oh. Right, your second row back here.
I'm Rob Sessingham. I'm with WUSF Public Radio in Tampa. And I just want to ask Mr. Sussman, I think this
been shut down in large part because of water considerations. We have citrus, we have construction. Like, how, what's the political consideration for some of these rules to be implemented? And is that, should that not be taken into consideration at all, even if the science is very good?
Okay, so the question is, should economic considerations be factored into setting water quality standards?
We're not insensitive to economic considerations, and we're certainly not insensitive to political considerations. Having said that, the goal of the Clean Water Act is very clear. It's to produce water bodies which are fishable and swimmable, and water quality standards under the Act are required to be protective of the designated uses. And in setting those standards, economics are not directly relevant. Having said that, we need to understand the economic impacts of what we do. We need to look for compliance and implementation strategies which are cost effective. We need to maximize flexibility wherever we can, where there's no loss of water quality protection. I would say that I'm personally disappointed with the quality of the discourse in Florida on the economic impact of our nutrient standards, because I do think that there's been a lot of misinformation in that debate, and it's been unfortunate. I think it's obscured the issues. Just to be clear, we concluded in our economic analysis of the standards that the impact on the average household in Florida would be $8 a year, as compared to the $700 a year estimate that we heard from others, and we concluded that the annual cost of the standard would be in the range of $100-$150 million a year, as compared to the $10-$20 billion a year projections that some in the regulated community were making. And you know, certainly there are going to be differences of opinion over economic impacts, but as David was saying before, we need to do a reality check when we develop these economic impact estimates, and we need to make sure that we're not making assumptions about what it will cost and what it will take technologically to achieve standards which are not based in reality and are not realistic. I think on the whole, we feel that these standards are eminently achievable economically. We also feel that they deliver economic benefits to the people of Florida. Recreation and tourism are very important industries down here, and the sustainability of those industries over the long term depends on water quality. If Florida's waters are fouled by algae blooms, that's going to impact recreation, it's going to impact fishing, it's going to impact tourism. So we need to understand that there are costs, obviously, of putting standards in place, but there are also costs to not putting standards in place, and those need to be taken into account.
Let's see. I would like to follow up just a little bit on that.
Real quickly.
Yeah, briefly.
I've got two pieces of information here, and one I'm going to quote from Pete Silva. Pete Silva is the former assistant administrator for the Office of Water. He made this quote back in the early part of 2010, and he did a really nice Q&A with the publication Inside EPA, and this quote is quite telling in my estimation, Bob. It says, if you take – this is a quote from Pete Silva, Assistant Administrator for Water, back in 2010. It says, if you take the bold step to say that you're not going to have, for example, new permits or any expansion of existing permits, that is almost growth limiting. I think that's an understatement. That relates to not giving any new building permits, which is obviously a political issue and an economic issue, especially now the way the economy is. That's the kind of hammer and velvet glove that EPA wields. And, you know, you can be sensitive to cost, but if you're carrying out programs where you're telling states that, you know what, you're done, no more building, no more roads, no more things that benefit society, you know, that's a tough pill to swallow, Tim.
Question here.
Tom Henry, I'm an former environmental writer. I'm an editorial writer and a columnist for the Toledo Blade. I agree with what you said, Don, in a macro sense. You're under pressure, you're doing more farming on less land, but that phenomenon is probably the result more of market-driven forces, corporate agriculture, the rise of corporate agriculture, not because everyone decided to start putting in buffer strips. And my question is that, as Robert was saying, there are many other costs on the other end by the pollution that are killing other industries. In Lake Erie, it's killing the charter boat fishing capping. We're down 100 from 800 to 700 in 1 year because of the algae pollution there. It's killing recreation tourism, driving down property values, driving up the cost for treating municipal water. Are we entering an era, do you think, where good old agriculture, which has been largely unregulated, needs to be more regulated, whether it's a requirement for more buffer strips, not voluntary, but a requirement for more buffer strips, and a requirement for more targeted application of phosphorus, nitrogen. Ohio State University study just showed that almost all farmland in the state of Ohio, in all 88 counties, is oversaturated with phosphorus, and the policy right now is to basically cross your fingers and hope it doesn't rain.
All right, so the question, to try to boil that down, is the state of the environment, the state of the water, such that farming needs to be regulated or more regulated than it is now?
Okay, Tom, I think the answer to that is no, and for a really good reason. Farmers in agriculture is probably one of the most scientifically based industries out there in terms of our extension service, in terms of our university land grant systems. Farmers internalize new science quicker than I think just about everybody else because they can do it year to year. We are using precision agriculture. We are using something called Green Seeker that's going to be very precise. The industry, in the terms of nutrients, we're advocating the use of, you know, the right product at the right place at the right time and at the right rate. I think understanding the real serious issues that there is out there in Lake Erie, we need to focus on those real serious issues and get to the bottom of the complexities of that issue. I will say, from my point, and I said this to begin with, if you look at some of the work the National Science Foundation has done, farmers are applying less nutrients right now from a bench chemistry standpoint than they are removing in the form of grain. That is an important component. If you know, what I'm trying to say is, in the aggregate, farmers are removing more nutrients, not nitrogen and phosphorus, in the form of the products they take off of the land than they are subsequently applying. Does that say we're not having problems? No, but it says the complexity of addressing those problems is not simply over-application. And if we want to get at and continue to increase our efficiencies, you have to have an open architecture. If you lock farmers in, you're going to lock them in. You're going to lock in their yields. You're going to lock in their productivity. You're going to lock in their efficiencies. And I think that is not what we want. I think we want to get on an effort where we address the problems and we figure out what those are. Are there more innovative solutions? Yes, there are out there, and we need more, but the issues are complex.
Can you cite, at least in the rough ballpark, what National Science Foundation study? Is it a study or report?
If you will look at the work, it's two pieces of work primarily done out of the University of Illinois by a gentleman, not in the Department of Agriculture, but in the Department of Environmental Sciences, a gentleman by the name of Mark David. And he's done studies in both nitrogen and in phosphorus.
Okay.
Mark David, D-A-V-I-D.
Yeah. The question here?
Yeah. Tom Homer, Ledger Lake, Mr. David. Isn't a lot of piece of your criticism of what's happening because it's a delaying tactic as much as anything else?
Oh, absolutely. That's what's going on.
The question is a lot of this an effort is to delay the delay action?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's what's going on. Is that that's what's been going on all along. The effort to establish these numeric limits to stop the toxic slime outbreaks actually began with an initiative in the Carol Browner era in 1998, and what we've seen is stonewalling for. We filed our lawsuit 10 years later saying it's been too long. And here we are in 2011, and we have the state proposing a standard that would be unenforceable till the indefinite future. That's what this is about. It's about delay. And delay is the enemy of clean water, because what happens is that you take a place like Wakulla Spring, which is this magnificent place, that got out of control, and it's not clear that it will ever be possible to restore that to where it was. Certainly, we're talking about generations, and that's true throughout the state. There are lakes that flipped over from this kind of pollution, like Lake Apopka flipped over in, 1950 or something, around that period. It's been 60 years, and it's still gone. It may never come back. And so this is something you really have a huge advantage of dealing with up front rather than delaying on it. And I think one of the political realities about that we're really not copping to here is that we have a Tea Party administration in Florida. The governor's a Tea Party guy, the whole legislature is, and his whole administration is. And it seems sort of, to a reasonable person, counterintuitive that an anti-regulation administration would come up with a palatable rule that effectively regulated industry and protected the environment. That would be totally out of character, and what they've done corresponds to who they are.
Drew, I think you wanted a quick response.
Well, I was hoping not to end on the Tea Party thing, but...
what brand do you drink?
I'm right. Drinking water right here. There's your political voices that go out on this whole thing. But the one thing I wanted to point out is in Florida, we're talking about setting numeric nutrient standards. And you really got to think about what is the purpose of setting those standards, because the standards themselves are not going to restore the water body. That just takes investment and income and things like that to actually restore Wakulla Springs, Lake Apopka, the Caloosahatchee River, St. Lucie River. All those efforts are underway. The reason the department invested in getting these nutrient standards derived so that they could get put on the books was because they are needed to prevent future impairments. And so those water bodies that are currently healthy, and there are a number of healthy water bodies in the state of Florida, it is very important that we not let them get unhealthy. And that's why you need water quality standards. And so it's just important to understand really the crux of why it's an important issue to have them.
Okay. In the back here.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Barnett with Florida Trend magazine, and I thought that maybe for the journalists who are from outside Florida, and Don, correct me on this if I'm wrong, the GDP for agriculture now in Florida is about 2% of the total economy, and I think people don't realize that. I think it's a much bigger piece of the pie. And then the other point is that the debate is often talked about in terms of food, and I think that Florida's largest agricultural crop is now horticulture, including sod and landscape materials. So I just thought that might be an important point to people who, you know, from outside of Florida who don't realize that. Is that accurate?
The question is basically, isn't it so that agriculture is a relatively small percentage of the state's economy and that food production isn't that dominant anymore?
If your numbers are correct, nationally that is not the case. I deal more national in scope, and I probably should have boned up on those numbers, and I apologize for not doing that.
These are from Enterprise Florida, which is our state economic development arm, and I think and our top crop is horticulture and has been. It's past citrus in the year 2000, I think. It's just a point of context because the tourism economy and the real estate economy is so big here.
I think I can help shed a little light on that. It is true that they're a very small fraction at 7 billion. People talk about 140 billion. The tourist industry is about 40 billion. But a bigger issue is that the surface area of the state is about 38 million acres, and 13 of that is in agriculture. And so, although it may be a small fraction of the money, it's, 40% or something like that of the land use.
Let's see. New question here. Yes, Carolyn.
Yes, Carolyn Wetzel, being in publications. I'm a California correspondent. And I just, this is just a basic question, not so much about the current, proposed standards, but what, whose responsibility or liability is for the historical loads to these waters? I mean, who's going to clean it up if the current ag industry and ratepayers don't pay it?
Okay, the question is, how do you deal with or who's responsible for dealing with the past pollution that is still having impact out there?
Bob, would you like to answer that one?
Well, you think he's in the driver's seat, huh?
Well, I can give a run at it. That is probably one of the biggest challenges is trying to figure out how to restore these water bodies. We've got a long-standing process that started in the 80s with the surface water improvement management plans and now working on basin management action plans. But really what it takes is getting everyone that's in the watershed to the table, local jurisdictions, state jurisdictions, agricultural entities, industrial entities, all at the table to apportion out that load. And that's what you do under the Clean Water Act is you apportion out load reductions among all the entities. And then a lot of it is handled in a municipal kind of way. And so you have to figure out where the source of funding is going to come from to install treatment works and to, get a hold of the landscape and how you need to make changes. And we have funding both at the federal level and at the state level and at the local level that all comes to the table to try to fund it. It is not cheap, and so you have to spread that funding over many years to try to get at that pollution problem.
Bob, you want to take a crack at that?
I'll leave that where it is.
Tim, I would like to kind of touch on something, particularly the question before that. I will say for the Chesapeake Bay, it's a little different than maybe here in Florida in the fact that only 10% of the Chesapeake Bay watershed is in agricultural production, land area-wise. Sure. And in EPA's model, your guide for making decisions, say that as much as 20% of that agriculture has to go away to achieve a standard. That's a big, big deal. And it would be also surprising for most of you people here to know that where EPA's biggest focus in that watershed is not on, I think, modern agriculture so much as it is on the plain sec agriculture that's going on in Pennsylvania. That power their operations by animals. That's probably more focus in some parts of that watershed than even, you know, people that are using modern science to achieve, I think, efficiencies and in environmental improvement.
Bob, we're really sort of out of time. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to respond, all right?
Right. I think the point David made is very critical. We don't regulate agriculture directly under the Clean Water Act. However, the contribution that agriculture makes to pollutant loadings obviously has to be addressed as part of any watershed process. I think in the Bay and elsewhere, we are looking to the states who do have the authority to regulate agriculture to figure out where the reductions are going to come from.
We're going to have to stop it here. Obviously, we could probably go on for some time. But I appreciate your attention and your good questions. And before I close, I got to make an announcement here. Beginning immediately after this session at the news podium, which is across the lobby up towards the elevators, the chief of the Forest Service, Tom Tidwell, is going to be there to discuss the service's new planning rule. This is a new rule that is intended to govern the management of all the national forests. And they've gotten over 300,000 public comments on it, so you can tell there's a great deal of interest in it. He'd be over there, be happy to answer your questions, probably talk about it. If you would, please join me in thanking our panel for discussion. And thank you for coming.